In a message on the Hajj pilgrimage, Iran's leader Ayatollah Khamenei calls on Muslims to resist aggression and interference of Western powers. Palestinians condemn as provocative Israeli raids on the Al-Aqsa Mosque compound ahead of a major Muslim feast. A major media investigation shows an Israeli spyware has been used to target activists, political leaders, and journalists across the world. Don Behrouz Najafi, good to have you with us. Now, starting with comments by leader of Iran's Islamic Revolution in a message to the Hajj pilgrimage, Ayatollah Khamenei has called on Muslims to resist aggression and wickedness of Western powers. The leader said that Muslim nations have mostly been subject to the aggressive Western countries' greed and interference over the past 150 years. Ayatollah Khamenei noted, "It's now time for the Muslim world to make up for the past." He said resistance against the U.S. and other transgressing countries will help Muslims take their fate in their own hands. The leader warned that the U.S. is trying to distort the will, demand, and actions of resistance forces in the region. He said that such efforts stem from America's deep ignorance of the awake and alert regional nations. A political analyst, Saif Husseini, says the most important message in the speech of Iran's leader is one of unity among Muslims across the world during Hajj pilgrimage.
Muslims of all nations, where they come to Hajj to have the greatest congregation of the world. His message also has been taken serious by the other nations, as some of them, they are all waiting what he says in his special message to the Muslims of the world. And normally he highlights the issues which all Muslims around the world are involved with, which for the last 40 years always he has been emphasizing on the issue of Palestine, the issue of unity. Recently, after the emerging Daesh or ISIS, he has been always warning the Muslim communities to avoid differences and to become united under one banner.
Iran condemns a ruling by a top EU court that allows the banning of headscarves under certain conditions. Foreign Ministry spokesman Said Khatibzadeh says that the verdict is a shameful, discriminatory measure against religious freedoms. He says the measure may lead to the rise of Islamophobia and violence against Muslims in European countries. The Luxembourg-based EU Court of Justice ruled on Thursday that employers may ban the wearing of visible symbols of religious or political belief, such as headscarves. The ruling says respective courts in the bloc's 27 member states should consider whether the ban corresponds to a genuine need on the part of employers. Palestinians have condemned the storming of the Al-Aqsa Mosque compound in the occupied Jerusalem Al-Quds by Israeli forces ahead of a major Muslim feast. The Palestinian Authority has held Israel responsible for the escalation resulting from the incursion in a Muslim place of worship. It's called the move provocative and a serious threat to security and stability of the entire region. Resistance groups, including Hamas and Islamic Jihad, have urged the Palestinians to make their way to the holy site to prevent Israeli raids. On Sunday, troops beat and forcefully evacuated Muslim worshippers from courtyards at the Al-Aqsa Mosque to clear the way for Jewish visitors. They fired tear gas and rubber bullets and arrested several people. The attack comes as Palestinians are preparing to celebrate Eid al-Adha on Tuesday. Meantime, Palestinians in the Gaza Strip have held a gathering to condemn Israel for its prolonged siege of the impoverished enclave, making daily life unbearable for them. A correspondent has more in her report.
Palestinian national and Islamic groups in the Gaza Strip held a gathering near the separation fence to slam Israel for stalling the flow of goods to the enclave. Attended by a number of Palestinian resistance leaders, The gathering voiced a resistance refusal of the Israeli attempts to provoke Palestinian outrage by widening the current blockade on the crossings connecting Gaza to the outside world.
This is a message to the Israeli regime to stop swaggering anger among Palestinians by imposing further restrictions on the reconstruction process in Gaza after latest escalation. What happened during the escalation might happen again, and the resistance is ready to defend Palestinians' rights under any condition. This inhumane siege is unacceptable. Our economy is already collapsed and things here are not bearable anymore.
Palestinian resistance called mediators and international community to redouble efforts to pressurize Israel into removing especially its restriction on building materials and construction work. The Israeli strikes displaced nearly 80,000 Gazans, including children, and destroyed 17,000 homes.
This Israeli blockade has negatively affected all aspects of life in Gaza. It has brought only further poverty and unemployment. Israeli regime is punishing our civilians twice, first by destroying their homes and second by denying reconstruction materials to them.
Palestinian resistance has warned that the new pressure by Israel will intensify the current tensions. They say are considering all options to break the siege.
It is unacceptable for Palestinians to remain silent towards this inhumane blockade that has only increased the poverty rate in Gaza. We call on the international bodies to put pressure on Israel to end this blockade. International community must stand for the humanity principles which have been violated by Israel in Gaza.
Israel imposed its suffocating siege on Gaza in 2007 after Hamas took control of the enclave in an election. Palestinians here say the delay in construction will affect the economic situation of Palestinian families, especially those who've lost their homes, by pushing up poverty rates. They also stress that the Israeli moves to impede the construction work in Gaza might trigger fresh violence. Ruba Shavit, Gaza.
Now, on the basis of different media outlets, a software by an Israeli firm has been used to spy on activists, political leaders, and journalists across the planet. A major media investigation into a leak of 50,000 phone numbers has once again linked Israel's NSO group to surveillance on international figures. The firm's Pegasus software was reportedly used to hack people's devices, including that of a murdered Mexican journalist and a family members of murdered Saudi journalist Jamal Khashoggi. Different organizations have long warned against the misuse of the software and its threats to privacy and human rights. The NSO denies the accusation, saying it sells its technologies to prevent criminal acts. The Afghan government and the Taliban have agreed to speed up the peace negotiations held in Qatar. In their final statement, the representing delegations said that they were committed to going on with negotiations until a settlement is reached. The statement added that the two sides will work to provide humanitarian assistance throughout the country. The talks have started on Saturday and are aimed at bringing an end to the decades-long violence. In the past several months, Taliban militants have stepped up attacks in the country. The renewed violence has claimed the lives of many people. Now, at the same time, a new virtual session of the Supreme Council of the World Assembly of Islamic Awakening has kicked off in Tehran with a focus on the issue of sustainable peace and security in Afghanistan. The event was opened with the inaugural speech of the Assembly Secretary General, Ali Akbar Velayati. He slammed the destructive consequence of the U.S.'s occupation of Afghanistan under the pretext of war on terror, saying that American forces are now leaving the country in a humiliating way. Former Afghan President Hamid Karzai also attended the event. He said the fight against terrorism in his country deviated from its path. The Afghan people will never accept colonization, and Karzai stressed that Iran's contribution would accelerate the peace process in his country. Other attendees also stressed the importance of Islamic unity in improving the situation in Afghanistan. In other news, the German chancellor says that she's been shocked by the surreal flood devastation after visiting the deluge-hit areas.
Es ist erschreckend.
It's terrifying.
I would say there is no word in the German language to describe this devastation. However, what I have witnessed and what is incredibly comforting is how people are sticking together, how they are helping each other, the solidarity among people.
Angela Merkel said that the federal government and the state will work together to bring things to how they were. She said that they have to be faster in the fight against climate change. Merkel also promised swift financial aid to the flood-hit region. Days of extreme rainfall in Germany and Belgium have claimed the lives of 188 people. Rescue workers are still searching for survivors in parts of northwestern Europe. The death toll could rise as many people are still missing. Now let's take a look at Cuba. The country has been the scene of unrest and rival rallies over the past few weeks. The island nation is suffering from food and medicine shortages, and that's amid the pandemic. Officials pointed a finger at the United States.
The rally in Havana, with tens of thousands of Cubans taking part. They came together to voice support for the island's government and protest what they see as the U.S. meddling in their country's internal affairs. The rally was held just days after unprecedented unrest erupted in Cuba over an economic crisis aggravated by the coronavirus pandemic. Revolutionary leader Raul Castro and the Cuban president were among those attending the event.
We have come together to once again denounce the U.S. blockade, aggression, and terror. We could not put off this rally. The enemy has once again given everything to destroy the sacred unity and peace of citizens.
The Cuban president criticized the U.S. for spreading false information on social media. He also blasted Washington for defaming his government and inciting hatred and violence. He said the U.S. seeks to undermine peace and stability in Cuba. Criticism of U.S. policies vis-a-vis Cuba has not been limited to its shores. Russia has also accused the U.S. of plotting a color revolution in Cuba.
The logic is simple here. It has been tested on numerous occasions by Washington in various situations. But everything is the same, instigating color revolutions against undesirable regimes. At first, sanctions are introduced against them, and artificial problems are created or imposed from outside, which complicate the social and economic situation. On this basis, tensions are provoked, and anti-government sentiment is stirred up. When a critical mass is reached, the whole blame is laid on the national government. Labels are pinned on it, its activity is discredited, and thus the situation nears a collapse.
Iran, too, says the U.S. is the root cause of many of the problems in Cuba and should end its unilateral sanctions on the Caribbean nation. The bans were first imposed in 1960 in response to Havana's nationalization of U.S.-owned oil refineries following the Cuban Revolution. The sanctions were later extended. Even racial justice group Black Lives Matter publicly condemned the trade blockade, saying it's at the heart of Cuba's current crisis. In June, a total of 184 countries voted in favor of a UN resolution to demand an end to the US economic blockade on Cuba. Only the US and Israel voted against. That was the 29th consecutive year that the UN General Assembly called for the U.S. to end its Cuba embargo. Washington has ignored the international plea every time. U.S. President Joe Biden has called Cuba a failed state. The Cuban leaders deny that. But even if it's true, that claim serves more as an admission of guilt on the part of the U.S. than castigation of the island nation.
Let's see what we got for you on the ONL. The United States Air Force is sending more than two dozen F-22 stealth fighters to an exercise in the Western Pacific this month. And that accounts for around a fourth of the U.S. F-22 jets that are mission capable. Defense analysts say that the move sends a message to China at a time when the two countries are at odds over a variety of issues, including Taiwan and the South China Sea.
The United States Air Force is set to deploy approximately 25 F-22 Raptor fighter jets to Guam and Tinian Island this month. That means the Air Force will be sending nearly 25% of its F-22 mission to the Pacific. The move is part of Operation Pacific Iron 2021. The exercise is held in July and involves over 35 fighter jets and 800 personnel. It will take place at 3 airports in Guam and 1 on Tinian Island. The exercise is in support of the 2018 National Defense Strategy, which called on the U.S. military to be a more lethal, adaptive, and resilient force to counter long-term strategic competition, primarily from China and Russia. Defense analysts say sending such a large number of F-22 combat jets for the exercise serves as a warning signal to China at a time when relations between Washington and Beijing have reached rock bottom over a range of issues such as trade, Hong Kong, the South China Sea, Taiwan, and the origin of the coronavirus pandemic. Despite America's military mania and lust for power, Washington has become a loser in the great power competition, or at least it will be. China is on the course to overtake the US and become the biggest economic powerhouse in the world within the next decade. China had hoped for an improvement in relations under US President Joe Biden, who succeeded Donald Trump in January. But the new administration has shown no sign of backing down on Trump's hardline policies toward China. Sending two dozens of fighter jets to an exercise in the Western Pacific amid rising tensions between Washington and Beijing proves that the Biden administration is pursuing a policy of confrontation instead of cooperation.
That's all right for this news broadcast from Tehran.
A diverse range of programs. Spirituality. Youth. Eastern Tales. Roundtable discussions. Culture. Politics. All produced by IRIB English Radio.
South Africa's President Cyril Ramaphosa has warned of vaccine apartheid as millions of people in poor countries are dying of the coronavirus with no access to vaccines and wealthy countries are hogging shots. We're prepared for you an article written by staff of the Reuters news agency. The piece is titled, After Hoarding, West bickers on sharing patents as virus kills in droves. major Western European countries have expressed reservations about a proposal to waive patent rights on COVID-19 vaccines, insisting that key to ending the coronavirus outbreak was faster manufacturing and sharing the vaccines. The recent development came as experts emphasized that waivers could take years to negotiate and would not address the immediate need to rapidly manufacture more doses of the vaccines, saying that while the pandemic rages on across the globe, it is highly likely that even more dangerous new variants of the contagion will emerge. However, the pharmaceutical industry in the United States and Western Europe claims that the most expedient approach is to overcome existing production bottlenecks and sell or donate vaccines to other countries around the world. France's President Emmanuel Macron said the question of sharing patents was not the issue of the day, slamming Britain and the United States for blocking the export of vaccines and their ingredients to the wider world. Meanwhile, European Union leaders were due to discuss the suggestion to share vaccine intellectual property at a two-day summit that opened in the Portuguese city of Porto on Friday, but remained divided on its usefulness. Some European Union officials argue that it could take 2 years to agree on the waivers in the World Trade Organization, WTO, most likely making it irrelevant to the current pandemic. French President Emmanuel Macron said prior to attending the summit, Macron said, what is the current issue? It is not really about intellectual property. Can you give intellectual property to laboratories that do not know how to produce and will not produce tomorrow? The main issue for solidarity is the distribution of vaccine doses. Emmanuel Macron went on to note that France was working hand in hand with Germany on this issue. Berlin expressed its opposition to the patent waiver proposal recently. This is while the European Union, which is among the biggest producers of vaccines in the world, is also the major exporter, with 200 million doses already shipped outside the bloc. However, the United States and Britain have not exported any of the vaccines that they have made. Lashing out at both the United States and Britain, Emmanuel Macron said, in order for the vaccine to circulate, the ingredients and the vaccines themselves cannot be blocked. Today, the Anglo-Saxons block many of these ingredients and vaccines. European Commission President Ursula von der Leyen echoed Emmanuel Macron's remarks, saying during a press briefing after the first day of the Porto summit that the European Union should be open to a discussion on the patents, but added that sharing the technology was no quick remedy for the pandemic. She added, in the short and medium term, the intellectual property waiver will not solve the problem. It will not bring a single dose of the vaccine in the short and medium term. The leaders of Belgium, Sweden, France, Denmark, and Spain said in a joint letter to the European Union Commission, "No one will be safe until we are all safe. If vaccination takes place only in developed countries, our victory over COVID-19 will only be short-lived. We're seeing how quickly the virus is mutating, creating new variants that entail new challenges." They emphasize that vaccines have become security policy and the European Union can't afford to lag behind. To this end, an increased European production capacity will be a key priority. Developments came after U.S. President Joe Biden recently backed a call from India and South Africa to waive patent protection for COVID-19 vaccines amidst a global surge of COVID-19 cases and in response to pressure from Democratic lawmakers and more than 100 other nations, but enraging pharmaceutical companies. U.S. Trade Representative Catherine Tai said the extraordinary circumstances of the COVID-19 pandemic call for extraordinary measures, committing to text-based negotiations at the World Trade Organization, WTO. Meanwhile, though it is the world's biggest vaccine maker, India continues to struggle in efforts to produce and distribute enough vaccine doses to stem the wave of COVID-19 in the country. The second wave of the coronavirus pandemic hit India and has brought the nation's healthcare system to the brink of collapse, with patients dying due to lack of oxygen or because of not having access to hospital beds. Officials said European Union leaders are likely to hear advice from the bloc's executive, the European Commission, that a waiver would not help boost production, especially in poorer countries, as the manufacturing process requires advanced technologies and facilities. The US firm Moderna waived patent rights in October on its vaccine, which uses the latest mRNA technology, but no other firm has yet announced that it will try to copy the shot. European Union officials said Germany, home to BioNTech, which owns a patent on another mRNA vaccine developed jointly with Pfizer of the United States, opposes waivers, while Italy supports them. According to press reports, Washington has long played as both architect and enforcer of the intellectual property regime, threatening sanctions against countries such as Brazil, Thailand, and South Africa for daring to promote the generic production of life-saving medicines. Meanwhile, South Africa's President Cyril Ramaphosa has warned of vaccine apartheid as millions of people in poor countries are dying of the coronavirus with no access to vaccines and wealthy countries are hogging shots. South African President Cyril Ramaphosa wrote in a weekly newsletter that COVID-19 vaccines should be a global public good. He said, "It is about affirming our commitment to the advancement of equality and human rights, not just in our own countries, but around the world." Cyril Ramaphosa added, "A situation in which the populations of advanced, rich countries are safely inoculated, whilst millions of people in poorer countries dying in the queue, would be tantamount to vaccine apartheid." According to the World Health Organization, WHO, the sub-Saharan Africa has administered the fewest vaccines relative to its population of any region, with roughly 8 doses per 1,000 people versus 150 doses per 1,000 people globally. Foreign leaders have repeatedly called on the Biden administration to provide help on accessing coronavirus vaccines. However, Joe Biden has said his administration will help the rest of the world only after all Americans have access to the vaccines. That means worst-hit countries such as India are likely to cross new and grimmer milestones. The health minister in India, meanwhile, recently said it was running out of vaccines and with just 3 to 4 days of supplies remaining of AstraZeneca as the coronavirus infections and deaths held close to record daily highs. Sonia Gandhi, the chief of the main opposition Congress party in India, accused the government of Prime Minister Narendra Modi of abdicating its responsibilities by leaving vaccinations to states. Government data shows that India, which is the world's largest vaccine producer, had fully vaccinated just over 34.8 million people, or about 2.5% of its population, of about 1.35 billion people, by Monday, 3rd of May. Prime Minister Narendra Modi has come under pressure for his handling of the situation. The Indian Medical Association, the IMA, said he needs to impose a complete, well-planned, pre-announced lockdown on the country. New Delhi entered a fourth week of lockdown with tougher curbs such as the shutdown of the suburban rail network while residents scrambled for scarce hospital beds and oxygen supplies. America's top coronavirus advisor, Anthony Fauci, also said he had advised Indian authorities they need to shut down. Meanwhile, Venezuela, which is under harsh U.S. sanctions, continues to fight the pandemic with the help of China, Russia, and the Islamic Republic of Iran. According to Venezuela's health ministry, it has received around 1.4 million doses of vaccine from China and Russia. It also hopes to receive doses for about 5 million people from the World Health Organization's COVAX program. Furthermore, Sudan in Africa is struggling to provide hospital beds, drugs, and medical oxygen to its patients. The country, with a population of over 40 million people, has been hit by a third wave of coronavirus infections. Health officials have recorded about 35,000 cases and over 2,700 deaths since the start of the pandemic. Officials say the real numbers are likely to be much higher given the low rates of testing in Sudan. In Malaysia, Prime Minister Mohiuddin Yassin announced new lockdown measures as the country grapples with a surge in the cases of infection and highly infectious variant of the coronavirus. The Malaysian Prime Minister Mohiuddin Yassin said all interstate and inter-district travel will be banned along with social gatherings. Mohiuddin said Malaysia is facing a third wave of COVID-19 that could trigger a national crisis. According to the latest data collected by Johns Hopkins University, the coronavirus pandemic has so far claimed the lives of about 3,299,000 people around the world and infected over 158.6 million people across the world.
The Spotlight.
Hello and welcome to Spotlight. I'm Marzia Hashemi. Thanks so much for being with us. Well, since the victory of the Cuban Revolution against imperialism in 1959, Havana has been targeted and never forgiven by Washington. This after Cuba nationalized its own resources and threw out the American companies which were profiting from Cuban resources. Now, the United States could never tolerate this small nation daring to take a stand against it so close to American shores. Recently, there have been demonstrations as the Cubans continue to deal with harsh American sanctions, and the president of this island nation is pointing the finger at Washington once again for provoking and encouraging unrest in Cuba. Well, stay with us as we put the spotlight on Cuba this edition.
The rally in Havana, with tens of thousands of Cubans taking part. They came together to voice support for the island's government and protest what they see as the U.S. meddling in their country's internal affairs. The rally was held just days after unprecedented unrest erupted in Cuba over an economic crisis aggravated by the coronavirus pandemic. Revolutionary leader Raul Castro and the Cuban president were among those attending the event.
We have come together to once again denounce the U.S. blockade, aggression, and terror. We could not put off this rally. The enemy has once again given everything to destroy the sacred unity and peace of citizens.
The Cuban president criticized the U.S. for spreading false information on social media. He also blasted Washington for defaming his government and inciting hatred and violence. He said the U.S. seeks to undermine peace and stability in Cuba. Criticism of U.S. policies vis-a-vis Cuba has not been limited to its shores. Russia has also accused the U.S. of plotting a color revolution in Cuba.
The logic is simple here. It has been tested on numerous occasions by Washington in various situations. But everything is the same, instigating color revolutions against undesirable regimes. At first, sanctions are introduced against them, and artificial problems are created or imposed from outside, which complicate the social and economic situation. On this basis, tensions are provoked, and anti-government sentiment is stirred up. When a critical mass is reached, the whole blame is laid on the national government. Labels are pinned on it, its activity is discredited, and thus the situation nears a collapse.
Iran, too, says the U.S. is the root cause of many of the problems in Cuba and should end its unilateral sanctions on the Caribbean nation. The bans were first imposed in 1960 in response to Havana's nationalization of U.S.-owned oil refineries following the Cuban Revolution. The sanctions were later extended. Even racial justice group Black Lives Matter publicly condemned the trade blockade, saying it's at the heart of Cuba's current crisis. In June, a total of 184 countries voted in favor of a UN resolution to demand an end to the US economic blockade on Cuba. Only the US and Israel voted against. That was the 29th consecutive year that the UN General Assembly called for the U.S. to end its Cuba embargo. Washington has ignored the international plea every time. U.S. President Joe Biden has called Cuba a failed state. The Cuban leaders deny that. But even if it's true, that claim serves more as an admission of guilt on the part of the U.S. than castigation of the island nation.
I'd like to welcome my guests to the spotlight. Out of Leesburg, Dennis Ma, Latin American expert. And out of Washington, D.C., Shel Labash, writer and anti-imperialist activist. Thank you both for being with me. Let's start this off with Dennis. Your perspective, how do you assess the effect of over 60 years of sanctions by the U.S. on Cuba?
Well, I think these sanctions have been wrong for each and every one of those 60 years. But unfortunately, what we're facing today is a very different context than what has existed until now. And I think that the current sanctions against Cuba and the activities in the Caribbean more broadly are actually very, very dangerous. What I mean is the following. We're facing an international financial breakdown crisis underway in the transatlantic sector. This is something which my magazine, Executive Intelligence Review, has documented in detail. And what you therefore have is among those big financial interests, an intent on a radical shift in the direction of world politics as a whole. I think that the blockade and what's happening with Cuba is even worse than it has been described in two regards. First, it is under conditions of a pandemic that was mentioned, I think, very importantly so in your lead up to this discussion. Under current conditions where we have a global pandemic which is out of control, to impose sanctions on countries that are facing this is tantamount to genocide. And I would like to strongly agree with what the Secretary General of the United Nations, Antonio Guterres, has said, which is that all sanctions should be lifted under these conditions. I personally believe all sanctions should be lifted altogether, but certainly under these conditions. This is what's happening in various countries with the pandemic. It makes the issues of sanctions and regime change and color revolutions all the worse. Mm-hmm. The second feature of the current development, which I think is really serious, is that it occurs along with similar and related activities in places like Haiti and in South America, and in South Africa as well, not just South America, but South Africa. So I'll leave that for further elaboration.
Okay, well, Shel, what about what Dennis said? I mean, he talked about the UN Secretary General Guterres and basically saying, especially under these conditions with the pandemic, that sanctions should be removed. What does that mean exactly? If the UN Secretary General is saying that, if the majority of member states are for that, but then nothing happens, nothing changes. So tell me, what's going on here? What does it all mean?
Well, It all means, as my colleague said, that there is a global initiative on the part of the United States to restructure the world under its domination. Those days are past, but they are not sparing anyone in their striving for hegemony. If you look at, of course, all of the sanctions should be lifted. It's unjust for unilateral economic war to be perpetrated on the people around the world. And Cuba's only one place. It's just the longest one and the one that's closest to the United States. But all of the sanctions should be lifted. I mean, has anybody looked at the fact that without a global response to the pandemic, the coronavirus is not going to go away? And the people who do not have vaccines are basically being thrown to death. And human beings are not expendable. That's a little bit the problem. You see this settler colonial imperialist attitude on the part of the United States saying, well, we're vaccinating people here. But the fact of the matter is, until the whole world is protected against the coronavirus, no one is going to be saved.
Let me cross back over to Dennis. I mean, it's part of a live program, right? Well, Dennis, your take on, you heard what Cheryl was saying. I mean, at the end of the day, what is the U.S. after in continually putting this type of pressure on Cuba? Because she talked about basically that every life is relevant and valuable, but it doesn't seem to be part of the equation in that settler colonialist mentality. How do you see it?
Well, I think you have to distinguish. There's different forces at play inside the United States, as there are in many countries around the world, and I think it's important to understand that there are distinctions and different points of view. Let me explain what I mean. There is an alternative that has been built over the last number of years internationally to the current bankrupt world financial system. And just parenthetically, when I say bankrupt, I mean bankrupt. You have $2 quadrillion in derivatives and financial speculation, which cannot be paid. And the attempt to hold up that bubble is what is behind the war drive. It is what is behind the austerity leading to the pandemic. It is what is behind all of these regime change operations, not just in a country like Cuba or Iran or Venezuela, but attempted regime change in Russia and China. That's what you're getting from the Wall Street and the City of London crowd. But the alternative that is existing at this point and that needs to be backed is what the Chinese have initiated with the Belt and Road Initiative, which many countries have joined in on at this point. In fact, the majority of the world's population, which has a different kind of approach to economics, which is not speculation and looting, but rather infrastructure and economic development. You can see the differences in the way the pandemic has been taken on. Now, we have an immediate situation around Afghanistan, which is, on the one hand, a very gravely dangerous situation, but also offers opportunities for a new kind of approach. Dangerous because with the departure of American troops, which is 20 years overdue after a 20-year war, and which many people in the United States, even included in the military, think that these perennial wars have simply got to stop. But you have a situation where, on the one hand, Afghanistan could easily tilt into becoming a center of world terrorism, of world drugs, of geopolitical destabilization and explosions. On the other hand, you have a confluence of forces coming together around the recent SCO meeting where the neighbors of Afghanistan, even though they have differences among them.
Okay. Well, now it seems to be Dennis's turn.
The forces that can actually help build.
Okay. Dennis, I'm sorry. I think it's your turn right now. We're having a little technical difficulty with you. Let me cross back over to Cheryl now. Cheryl, when we look at it, I mean, even when we're talking about the blockade or the sanctions on Cuba. I mean, isn't the main problem, it's not just the unilateral sanctions by the U.S. It's that the United States will punish or sanction any entity that actually want to have economic relationship with the country. Otherwise, if it was just the United States in itself, there would be so many other alternatives, but that it shuts down everyone and all other countries. Your take.
Yes. The extraterritorial nature of the blockade is really what is insidious. People in the United States, when they saw Barack Obama go to Cuba, it was like, everything is fine now. There's no blockade, relations are quote-unquote normal. But the fact of the matter is, even then, the blockade, the economic sanctions, the economic warfare against Cuba continued. And what happens is the laws are so convoluted and complex that it becomes almost impossible to have trade. For example, to have a sale of pharmaceuticals, according to the U.S. law, you have to have a license. Okay, that's fine. To get that license, you have to agree to send a person to Cuba to verify that the end users are the end users. It's not a free and fair trade arrangement where people can, you know, Cubans can buy from the United States and people and businesses can sell. It's all controlled by the U.S. government, and they make conditions so onerous that it's impossible to do. And then third countries, like, for example, one that's used frequently is that the embassy, the Cuban embassy in Canada, leased Honda vehicles. Should be simple. They go to a Honda dealership in Canada, they lease the vehicle. It turned out that Honda was fined for doing that, because the financial route goes through California, where their leasing office, their big international leasing office is. So even the small thing of leasing a vehicle, of getting deliveries from DHL, now remittances are cut because Western Union can't process remittances to Cuban families. The web is just so hard to negotiate, and it affects the whole world. That's really what's happening, and that's why it needs to end completely. There's the people of the United States are standing up against the blockade. We have resolutions from elected officials and city labor councils all across this country, representing more than 30 million people in the United States. We have people in every state of the union who will stand up and say, hands off Cuba. We are growing the movement here to tell the U.S. government that it is time to end the blockade, and that we're not going to be distracted by this, you know, by all of these lies about what's happening in Cuba that are being fomented through a cyber war.
Dennis, you heard what Shell said, but I want to look at one aspect of that, because she talked about the growing numbers, the grassroots movement. But in general, is it about the numbers? Because if we're talking about majority, we know that 189 countries actually voted against continued sanctions. So she talked about 30 million people, for example, grassroots movement. Is it about the number of people that can pressure the U.S. government, or is it about the 1% which controls the U.S. government that actually, that's where they make the whatever decision they want to make?
I don't think it's either. I think the growth of 30 million people on policies that are appropriate is very good. But I want to emphasize that we're facing a different situation than we've been looking at for decades. There is a world financial breakdown crisis underway. That opens great dangers and great possibilities for a change in the big picture. If we don't change that big picture, the littler pictures, with all due respect to smaller countries, is not going to change. You have on the global strategic scene an alternative which is being put together around the Belt and Road Initiative, and that is an extraordinarily important counterweight which is an area which people inside the United States should link up with. To bring sufficient pressure on this to change the situation, you're going to have to address the underlying blowout conditions in the world financial system and the economy, which is springing up these crises, creating these crises in various places. Listen, on this Cuba question, the president of Haiti was assassinated 4 or 5 days before the big demonstrations or the little demonstrations in Cuba, the unusual demonstrations in Cuba. Within 2 days of the president of Haiti's assassination, one of the three governments of Haiti that was claiming to be the government called for the United States to send in troops. Now, as of now, the Biden administration has said no, but it's not a very strong no. And I believe this is a very real possibility, given that there are people who are looking for a war with Russia around Ukraine and a war with China around Taiwan. So I think it's very important to look at the big picture. People should recall that Cuba is closer to Haiti than it is to the United States. We have the proverbial 90 miles or 103 miles between Cuba and Florida, but there's 60 miles from Cuba to Haiti. And the part of Cuba which is closest to Haiti is Guantanamo. Now, I'm not saying we're going to have another Bay of Pigs tomorrow, but I am saying there is an intention from a policy layer internationally to create crises everywhere to maintain their global system in place, and it's a financial system. Therefore, I think it's most useful to look at how to affect that global problem, change that, if we hope to have changes in policy such as this not only criminal but really stupid policy, suicidal policy of sanctions against countries like Cuba or Venezuela or Iran and so forth. I mean, after all, we may think that we have a wall built around the rest of the world on the pandemic, but I would recommend that people read Edgar Allan Poe's story on the Mask of the Red Death as to what happens when people think that they can simply wall themselves out of a problem which is international and the pandemic does not respect borders or anything of the sort. It's good we've got vaccines here. The whole world should have them, but the vaccines will not stand up to new variants if we don't guarantee that the entire planet is safe from this problem. So that's what I mean by the global problems.
Shell, your take, because we're just about, we're running out of time. What needs to happen to change the status quo? I mean, we've been looking at this since 1959, since the victory of the Cuban Revolution in that country, the continual pressure by the U.S., the sanctions by the U.S., the military aggression also, and threats. What has to change?
Well, what has to change is what we in the United States can do, because fundamentally, even though we laud the support from around the world and the voices from around the world, and it's very necessary, but fundamentally it's our responsibility. It is a government that is acting in our name. And we have to really find a way, and that's why I emphasize that we've been doing this grassroots work. We have elected officials, we have elected bodies. I couldn't agree more that there are at least three, maybe more international crises that are transforming our world, not in a good way. One is the economic financial crisis, one is the pandemic, and the other is the environment. These crises are not going to be postponed. They're going to cause all sorts of problems and hardships inside our country, countries generally. Okay. So we have to step up the fight here at home.
And Dennis, 40 seconds. What needs to happen in your perspective?
The United States should join with China, Russia, and other countries in the Belt and Road Initiative. The fact that President Biden did sit down to talk with Putin is very positive, even though nothing in particular came out of that, except the continuation of talks, recently a four-hour discussion. It is in the self-interest of the United States to work, for example, with China to build up the economic situation throughout the entire Caribbean region, Semexon. If you have illegal migration, you have to build these areas up economically and make them strong. And I think that this is something which the United States must be brought to understand is in our own self-interest.
Okay. And on that note, hate to interrupt you both, but I appreciate you being with us. We're out of time. Dennis Small, Latin American expert out of Leesburg, and Cheryl Labash, writer and anti-imperialist activist out of Washington, D.C. And as always, we appreciate you being with us on another Spotlight. I'm Marzia Hashemi. Goodbye.
Our voice comes from the heart of beautiful Iran. This is the Heart of Life Pounding. IRIB English Radio.
Fiqh or jurisprudence is an Islamic knowledge and is ranked
The Holy Prophet of Islam is the example
of
Self-purification is the most significant
factor.
Imamat is a living principle in the history of Islam and Shiism.
This is Ulama Speech, the best selection of the speeches of prominent Shia scholars.
In the name of Allah, the Beneficent, the Merciful. Assalamu alaikum, dear listeners of IRIB English Radio. Welcome to another episode of Ulama's Speech. In this episode, we invite you to listen to the English translation of a short speech by famous Iranian Shiite orator and lecturer, Hujjatul Islam Ali. Stay tuned.
شیطان مهمترین جایی رو که مورد هدف قرار میده در آخر زمان
The cursed Satan attacks the foundation of family and family bonds inside a society. His reason for this action is that the family is the most important place for the nurture and education of a child. If the family breaks up, then there will be no man or woman for serving the religion of God.
باز اینو من اشاره کردم که در روایات ما از آسیب‌های آخر زمان وقتی گفته شده.
Now, in our narrations, we can see that when the world is getting close to its end, some signs show up. Among these signs, some are directly related to the family. For instance,